Welcome to Smashing Business, everyone. I'm Warid Ahmed.
And I'm Abdul Majid.
And it is the 16th of January today. It's a Thursday. We're almost at the end of the week. There's big stories coming in. It's absolutely insane. How are you doing, Majid?
Very happy about the weekend, as always. But I was reading weird stuff in the morning. I don't know. It's a lot of stuff. But the most interesting thing that I read in the morning is, I was telling Casey about it, you see startup fundings for tech, fintech, this tech, that tech. But recently, a biosciences startup, Colossal Biosciences, they raised $200 million. And that is what caught my eye. I was like, who's investing $200 million in a startup which is related to biosciences? And the story is that they're trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. They're trying to bring back the Ice Age mammoth guy. So those things are extinct. And what they're trying to do is they'll sequence the whole genome of that person from the bones and whatever they found. And they'll put it in an embryo of the egg of the female elephant, plant it at the female elephant, and then we'll have the birth of the first woolly mammoth. So Ice Age guy, I don't remember his name. What was his name? The Ice Age
I completely
mammoth.
Forgot.
Yeah, so basically, that guy may come back. It's a weird story. Oh, Manny. Manfred Manny. So, yeah, startups and biosciences are getting a lot of money as well. Not only fintech, not only... whenever we talk about Middle East, usually it's fintech startup, something related to money or something about the tech space.
Money.
Biosciences. $200 million they got, and the company is valued at $10.2 billion. The name is Colossal Biosciences, the company name. It's a very weird, freakish story. And they're also trying to bring back the Tasmanian tiger. That's also extinct. And the dodo bird. They're bringing back the dodo bird as well. So yeah, that's how my day started.
I think what's entertaining me the most right now is how your eyes look like they're popping out of their sockets when you're describing this.
I love biology. I was a very avid biology guy. I still love biology. I read all these weird news whenever there's some new thing happening in the biological field. Not the floral side, trees and all that. It's not that interesting. But animals, humans, because it's basically what I am, right? Biology is all about knowing what's inside.
Are you calling yourself an animal?
Yeah. Categorically, in biology, I am considered one of the animals. No, human beings are like a species. Just the important thing about biology, I love to know what my nails are made up of. What's the chemical behind it?
You know, the blood running through my veins,
the composition and everything.
You're saying biology right now. It's so interesting that you say this because yesterday I was at the Under Armour press conference, Majid. Basically,
biology.
It was
fitness.
No. I'll tell you what happened. It was so interesting. I basically met this really famous athlete. Her name is Ghada.
Yeah.
Here in the Middle East, I met her and we were just having a conversation about being an athlete and why it's so important to work out. And this was like off camera. This was not on camera. And I was telling her, I was like, I do work out. I do work out, but I do
have. You run. I know this much.
I love running. I love running so much. But I do have days where it's like, because I had so much work to do, it will reach like 8 p.m. and it's like, I need to eat. And if I eat, then I have to wait a good 2 hours and then I can work out. So I miss it sometimes because I don't like working out in the morning. I like it at night more. No, at night, it's like you get to reflect. There's something about it that I love. Like I reminisce when I run. But point is, we were having a conversation and she went like, what's going to stop you from, missing some of your workouts is the fact that in 50 years, you're going to be in crutches. She told me that. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then she told me that working out, it's not about what's going on outside. It's about what's happening from within. And I'm like, explain that to me. She told me that when you work out, when you lift weights, the more weight that you can lift, the more that your body can run, it's signaling to the fact that your joint health is really good. It's signaling to the fact that your bone health, your bone density is really good. And Majid, she scared me. She scared me because for the longest time ever, I'll be honest with you, for me, working out was honestly about maintaining my appearance. It was about maintaining my body. It was about maintaining a certain image. Because, social media, it does impact you and make you think, okay, I have to look a certain way. But I never actually deeped how much working out impacts what's happening from within. No, I really didn't. I knew it. It's like there's a difference between knowing something and like knowing it. Like, you know it. And when she said that to me, like, you're gonna be in crutches, you're gonna be weak, I was like, oh my God, I need to go to the gym right now. But more than that, you know what she told me? I think Ghada's story was so interesting because she actually said that she started being an athlete when she was 39. Yeah, when she was 39 years old, she said, that's when I started everything. And she said, I started competing at age 40. And she told me about how she went to this race in Canada. Like, a bunch of people, they've been running for the longest time ever. She won. And they were like, who's this woman all the way, you know, from the Middle East? Like, who is she? And she was telling me and by the way, she was bursting with happiness. I've never met somebody that happy, mashallah. Her energy, it was so beautiful, Majid. Like, you could feel it. You could feel it. It was so beautiful. And she told me, like, even her husband, like, told her, never stop working out. Never stop doing this. She told me that because of the fact that, you know, even I made it a consistent thing, I became more happy. She went, like, I used to be so depressed. It was all fake smiles. So, no, biology is so important. And I think you're so right. And I am going to make it an aim of trying to get back into that. Because I'm one of those people who get consumed with my job. Do you not? I feel like we're the same in that sense. Yeah. I get overconsumed by my job, like, you know, reading things, you know, catching up with things. But it's like, you got to catch up with your body. You got to catch up with your health, man.
Physical and mental health are, like, interconnected.
It is. It is interconnected. And
the important thing, Gaza ceasefire.
Yes,
that's happened.
The Gaza ceasefire has been announced. There isn't anything official yet that's been announced, but they have outlined a 6-week initial ceasefire phase. So this is really exciting. It is really exciting, but I am also very nervous about it.
There's a lot of videos coming out of people celebrating it in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians across the world, wherever they are. Everyone who was on the side of Palestine, they're celebrating it. The final details, obviously, the office of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said that in a statement that final details are being ironed out, but it was announced by U.S., Qatar and Egypt. They basically came in between and worked out. There's a lot of news coming out that these are the main pointers of the deal that has been signed right now, that Israeli forces will move some 100 meters out, like 700 meters. So all the details are there, wherever you want to read it. But the main important thing is that it's finally been done. And obviously it will take some time to implement, and then it's a big thing, because Israeli forces, the genocide that they've carried out in Gaza, it's been going on for like now more than a year. Started October 7, it's been
October 7. I would not say a year.
It's more than a year, the bloodshed that's started in October 7, it's been like, it has a whole history, I know.
Yeah, but you know, Majid,
since October 7, it's been the most bloodiest, most devastating period of this whole, decades-long conflict, fight that's been happening.
It was reported that, you know, I've said this before, it was reported that over 45,000 people were dead, and that number, as you said before, is probably more. But what I find more interesting...
Yeah, recently someone did a report, I was reading it. I don't remember exactly, some firm, some NGO or someone, they did it, and they said that it was the deaths that have been reported like 41, nearly 40 or 41% less. So if you add those, it becomes nearly 90 or 90, at least 80,000 people. So it's been underreported 41%. And we obviously know there's hordes of people who were under the buildings, under the rubble, that couldn't be gotten out, and you couldn't count them because you never knew they were there.
So but, yeah, you know,
it's a big human catastrophe that's finally coming to an end.
I don't think it's finally coming to an end, because even after the ceasefire was actually announced, Israel did bomb Gaza,
reportedly,
and 32 people were announced dead, according to Reuters. Yeah. So I'm, you know, before I celebrate for them and celebrate with them, I'm I'm going to wait to see more.
Yeah.
We're definitely going to find out more. There's definitely more to this.
It's like, obviously, the thing that was happening in Syria is not no way comparable to what Israel did in Gaza. But even with Syria, we're still seeing it's been a month or at least a month that it's happened. And still, they're still thinking of what to do. They're still in the planning phase of the recovery. And obviously, with Gaza, it will also take a lot of time to come back to normal. But at least the world now knows that there's a ceasefire deal. So if anyone breaches that, most probably Israel, I don't think anyone would take their side. Even U.S. now won't take their side.
But the U.S. is, though. Just recently,
they signed an agreement now.
Biden signed an $8 billion arms deal with Israel.
But the good thing is, this time it's officially signed and U.S. was an intermediary. So if anything happens, U.S. will be like, you breached my trust this time. So yeah, this is happening. Let's go back to the business world. But thankfully, at least they finally sat on the table and signed something. Mm. That's the good part about it.
That is. And coming to our stories for the day, our first one is that Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal recently announced that his kingdom holding company is going to reopen Four Seasons Beirut in early 2026. Now, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal actually went on to share the statement, the press release statement on his X account, where Saudi and Lebanese flags were shaking hands. And what he had to specifically say was, Mr. President. And the president that he was referring to is General Joseph Aoun, who is the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese army, who was just recently elected the president of Lebanon. Now, this entire story, what I find so beautiful about it is that, we saw how, Israel led an invasion on Lebanon, and, them getting the Four Seasons Beirut back, it doesn't just signal to recovery, but it signals to such growing investor confidence in Lebanon. Businessmen are coming back to Lebanon. Lebanon is rebuilding, and this is so beautiful to see.
Yeah, and such a big guy coming back and revamping and rebuilding and refurbishing. There's so many re-words. Reconstructing the Four Seasons. It shows that it is going towards a recovery period. Out of all the conflicts that you see that have been happening in the Middle East, I think Lebanon was the most, in terms of time period, it was the shortest one, because they just came in, something happened, a ceasefire deal was signed, and then they left. They're still out there, but according to the signed papers, they left. But good thing is that they will have a quicker recovery. And I know it's bad to compare them with Gaza and the Syria conflict, but still, it's a happy news that they're recovering. That's the most important thing. That's the most important first step that you take after anything like this happens. So the route to recovery has started.
But more than that, it's Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal.
Yeah,
when I'm reading about Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal Majid, I always like to say that I don't think that it's his business that's the conglomerate. It's the family.
It's family.
It's his it truly is such a powerful conglomerate. And for him to be stepping into Lebanon, especially at a time like this, I think it also signals to, what he as, what he as a Saudi prince actually believes about conflict. Just recently, I watched an interview with him, and what he was saying was that he has a vested interest into peace, quote unquote. And then he said that, I care about peace nationally, internationally, and regionally. So I think that this entire reopening of the Four Seasons in Beirut, I don't just think that it's a business strategy from Kingdom Holding, which is owned by Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, but I also actually see it as a peaceful solution.
Yeah.
That's really also what I see it as. And it's interesting because the interview actually took place before this entire story.
Yeah.
So we can definitely see that it was in plan. They were planning it for a very long time.
Yeah, the most important thing is it's happening. I always love the stories where they finally take a decision and do something. And yesterday even, no, it was about Syria, the central bank of Syria. But Lebanon is a beautiful country, that I know. A lot of people who are Lebanese in our office, or the people that I meet in the UAE, there's a lot of people from Lebanon in the UAE.
My best friend is Lebanese. She's from Bitroun. And you know, it's
the stories that you hear about Lebanon, I still want to go. I will go someday. And I hope it comes back to normal as soon as possible.
I'm going for my best friend's wedding one day.
Nice.
I will. But, you know, Majid, I was speaking to my best friends yesterday. They actually saw the video that I made on this story on Smashy Business. And it really made me happy because one of my best friends, she's half Lebanese and she's half Saudi.
Oh.
And she told me that the story made her really happy for Lebanon, that they're finally rebuilding. And what makes this story even more emotional is the fact that, do keep in mind that the reason why the Four Seasons in Beirut is actually reopening and renovating. It's because of the 2020 port explosion in Beirut. And Majid, like, I experienced that explosion in real time because of a lot of our, I mean it in the sense of a lot of our family friends are from Lebanon. And so I remember, like, during that time in 2020, just to hear about, you know, the damaged homes, you know, the people, like, businesses that were destroyed, like, it made me, like, I remember, like, my father looking at me and saying, you know, I don't know if my friends are okay, you know, what happened to their homes, what happened to their businesses. So it's so beautiful to see that they're also finally recovering from that. And one extra point to add is this entire renovation is actually going to be carried out by Kingdom Beirut SAL, which is actually owned by and is a subsidiary of the Kingdom Holding Company.
Yeah, Kingdom Holding has Kingdom Investment Company, which has invested in countries, and this is one of the country company that Kingdom Holding has. Good thing to know, to be honest. I would love to go to the Four Seasons. I love Four Seasons. I've been to, like, one or two with my wife, but yeah, and they're really great. But
where have you been to it?
I don't remember. I've been to so many with my wife because she reviews them, I told you. So she reviews properties. Most probably she will be going when it opens, so I'll ask her, what's her review?
That's going to be really interesting to see. And now, speaking of hotels and all things tourism, we have really big news from Ras Al Khaimah. They have just reported a 12% increase in tourism revenues in 2024, fueled by record-breaking arrivals of 1.2 million overnight visitors. Now, you know, we see this as it comes with the openings of new hotels and resorts in Ras Al Khaimah, especially the expansion of international events. You know, there was more than 80 hosted, with a 15% rise in meetings, incentives, conferences, and exhibitions. When I see this, it's so special because Ras Al Khaimah is, it's diversifying, it's standing out. It's really standing out as a city, and especially in a country like the UAE, where you have Dubai, where
and
you
Abu
have, it's just so, it's so interesting because it's like, to me, the way that I see it, Majid, it's that Dubai to me, by the way, is all the glamour.
Yeah.
It's the glitz and the glamour. To me, Abu Dhabi, oh my God, Abu Dhabi's the money. That's where all the money is.
Yeah.
That's what I see it as. And Rack, I think what Rack is doing is that they're trying to become the touristy spot.
Yeah.
You know, the calming spot that you can go to, the getaway spot that you can go to when you're done with all the glitz, the glamour, the money. I think that's what Rack is for. That's what you can get to it.
I think Ras Al Khaimah has an advantage of seeing Dubai and Abu Dhabi do both of the things.
Mm.
So basically, Dubai is the packaging that you see over UAE, and the product inside is Abu Dhabi. But now Rack is like, okay, I can take the best of both, learn from whatever they've tried and tested over the years, and implement the best things that I can.
Mm.
So Rack has an advantage in this regard. An increase in tourism also, to be honest, it's the main thing is when you come to the touristy season of Dubai, you've seen it's become too crowded.
Mm.
And it's very nicely managed, to be honest. But again, everyone wants to come to Dubai like once, twice, thrice. It's the good thing is they have repeat customers.
Mm.
But now, finally, when everyone has seen everything, and new openings, new things are going to open like 1 or 2 years later, they're like, okay, let's go somewhere else. Ras Al Khaimah is the best place to go to right now because they're promoting it as well. That's the good thing about them. You see all the other Emirates, Sharjah never promotes its tourism. Sharjah promotes itself as a city of mosques and a very nice hub to work. There's a whole Sharjah.
Also a very cheap place to live. And when I say cheap, I mean in comparison.
In comparison to Dubai and Abu Dhabi, obviously it's way cheaper.
Because a lot of the people who a lot of the people who work in Dubai who want to afford cheap rent, they actually end up living in Sharjah.
Yeah, but they have to travel like 1-1.5 hours every day in the morning and the evening. Our producer Kirby can vouch for that. Every day he has to travel at least 1 hour in the morning and 1.5 hours in the evening. 2 hours in the
evening.
Yeah, so it's 3 hours of commute,
it's
but
dedication.
Obviously he saves a lot
in
rent.
That's real dedication.
Yeah, but main thing is Ras Al Khaimah, it was known for Iraq ceramics. Everyone knows that they were more about minerals and exploration. But now tourism is ramping up. They did a very nice record-breaking New Year's Eve fireworks display, drones display. Mm. That was good. I guess this is these. Armin van Buuren was there. Our team, I guess Natasha and Masa went to the concert. There were a lot of people. So all these events that they're adding to the calendar every year, more and more events, that and another thing, Wynn Casino. We can't forget it. So Wynn, the island that they've created, Al Marjan Island for Wynn Casino, that is going to be one of the top attractions in the UAE. And that's going to open around 2027, mid-2027 or third or fourth quarter. But people are going there to see actually what they're building, their future planning, basically.
But, you know, I remember even when I was at this real estate property show with Bengati, I remember so many of the real estate agents there that I was having conversations with, they actually mentioned the Wynn Resort.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, and don't forget that.
Yeah.
So they're completely excited about it. Yeah. But more than that, you know what I see Ras Al Khaimah as, Majid? I honestly see it as a city that really, the history there, they really stick to their culture. The history there, it's so beautiful. Like, you know, just very recently, I believe it was Khalij Times who did a story on them. But this business, this family business, it's called Ghan Barinia Heritage Business. Mm. They're basically selling over 3,000 carpets that are worth 1.884 billion dirhams. And they're basically, they're going to open a new showroom in Ras Al Khaimah. And not just that, like the fish markets there. Everything in Ras Al Khaimah just screams culture.
Yeah.
It screams roots. It screams going back to, you know, just having a simple life, something filled with culture and filled with experience. And, you know, I'm not saying that Abu Dhabi and Dubai, they're not filled with experience, but I just find Ras Al Khaimah to be such a breath of fresh air because of the fact that, you know, everything that they do, it has this cultural touch to it. It really does. And I think especially in the century that we live in now, I think that's something so beautiful because, you know, I really do believe this, Majid. You can live for money, but I feel like the things that really make you live, it's art, it's experiences.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm mentioning it again. Yes, I am. Coldplay. Like, you know, ever since I went to that concert, my mood has completely changed. And I notice this whenever I go to, like, you know, museums, whenever I go to just, you know, cultural shows, movies. My mood completely changes, by the way. For like a good week, a good 2 weeks, I am somebody else. And I feel like that's what Ras Al Khaimah is. You know, it gives people
to... Have you seen Dead Poets Society?
Yes, I have!
That is exactly what we're talking about. It just reminded me of
the... Yes, I have! Robin Williams.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite films.
You do all the stuff like engineering, medical, all that. But what you actually live for is experiences, love, care, all the things that you mentioned.
And it is,
traveling.
It is.
You actually earn and live for these experiences.
It so
That's
is.
That's actually living.
It so is, Majid, because it's like, I remember even like last week, like I do want to speak about this, like right before the Coldplay concert, by the way, happened, Majid, I feel like I was actually going through a mental crisis. I'm seriously not joking. I was completely burnt out. I was so burnt out. And I found it hard to just do my normal daily tasks. Even the simplest of tasks, I found it difficult to do because I was just so burnt out. I was feeling completely empty. It was so weird. No, seriously. And it would like carry with me throughout the entire day. And if you know me, that is not my attitude. That is not the way that I am. So that's why it freaked me out, because it was like, you know, where's the energy? Where is everything going? Like, you know, I even went to my mom and I'm like, Mom, like, am I not going to be who I am anymore? And then I went to the concert. And by the way, you know, I didn't even want to go to the concert. I didn't, because of the mood that I was in. I was like, you know, I don't think it's going to fix it. But let me tell you, ever since Coldplay, I am somebody new. But just on the topic of character, somebody yesterday said something really interesting to me, Majid. I won't say who they are on the show, but basically they were telling me, they were like, they don't like rich people. They were telling me that they don't like rich people.
It was me.
Yeah, it was Majid. But basically he was telling me that, you know, do you mind me speaking on this? That he doesn't like rich people because of the fact that they remind him of how lazy he is.
Yeah.
But when he said that to me,
I don't like them. I know the rich people, they worked hard for the money. It's just that it reminds me, they keep reminding me that I'm lazy.
But you're not lazy.
No, like, I should have done something with my life as well. Maybe I can do now. So it gives me the motivation as well, but it's kind of a feeling that, why am I not doing anything? So it's kind of a conversation that I have with myself whenever I see a person, even a rich entrepreneur, a young rich entrepreneur, like, who's made big name for himself. I don't say it's jealousy. It's kind of a two-edged sword. I get motivated to do something, like just give up and do what you want to do, which I want to do a lot of things, but then it also is like, why didn't you do it till now? So yeah, that's the main argument, rich people. I don't hate you. I just look at you and I'm like, I should do it. I should do something. I should like do what I want and become something. And then I think, why haven't I done it till now?
You know,
I guess everyone gets that feeling. It's not just me.
No, but you know, Majid, it's crazy that you actually, you said this, because out of everybody that I know, you know, I work under you. You're one of the most hardworking people that I know. It was crazy to me that he said that. Like, you know, it makes me feel like lazy. Like, Majid, you're one of the most hardworking people that I know. Like, keep in mind, guys, he wrote a book. He just told us this very recently.
Kept it on the side.
And it's like, for me, your statement, I found it shocking because of the fact that when I see rich people, they don't make me feel lazy, because the way that I see it is that wealth is a survival of the fittest. Yeah. And the way that a lot of them survived is simply by luck. And let me tell you something, Majid, I've grown up with a lot of wealthy people. I've met a lot of wealthy people in my life. And you know what the lesson that it taught me is? Wealth is in character. Honestly. Yeah.
Poor people say that. Usually poor people say that.
Are you calling me poor, Majid? No, I mean it.
People who have millions and billions, they'll never say that.
But Majid, like, I mean it. You know, I know a lot of wealthy people. And let me tell you something. It's a blessing as much as it is a curse. And the best thing that you can have in life is a wealthy character. Yeah. And when I say wealthy character, the way that I would define it is that your emotional intelligence. Like, do people enjoy sitting with you and having a cup of tea? You know, the family that you have, all of, and wealth in character, when I say wealth in character, I mean who you are, the way that you view life. Because I've seen people who'll be in the Swiss mountains and they're just bored. They don't care. So it's really all about the way that, you know, you view life.
I would love wealth in character with wealth in real also.
I know the combination is perfect. But it's like magic from knowing a lot of these people. It's like, It's truly all about wealth and character.
Yeah.
To me, when I see wealthy, it doesn't make a difference. It's so strange because it doesn't make a difference to my brain chemistry. It does not do anything whatsoever. Like, I don't think much of it. I don't care about it. Because in the end of the day, what I know about myself is that, you know, I know my character. I know the character that I have. And it's your character. That's the gold mine, by the way. Because some people, yes, they come across wealth by working really hard. Some people come across wealth because it's generational. And some people come across it by luck. So it's all in the wealth in your character and the way that you view life. It's really all about that. And it's funny because I told my sister what you said, by the way. No, because it shocked me. And you know what my sister said? I was speaking to her. She was like, to be honest with you, if anything, when I'm around wealthy people, I feel that I am that person. And that I will get there. And I remember, you know, somebody told me this story about, you know, their billionaire uncle, who was not always a billionaire. Yeah. You know what they said to me? They said that when my uncle barely had anything, they would, you know, they would still wear really nice clothes. They would still go to these events, and in a way, that's kind of just what they became.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of faked it till they made it.
It's a very cliche idea in every business and job, that dress the way that you want to be, or dress for the job that you want, not for the job that you have. So, yeah, that's the idea, that every day in the morning, whenever you're coming out of the house for a job or anything, dress the way that you would dress if you had, like, the perfect job, or if you had millions and billions. Don't dress like a person who's, like, on the road and is homeless.
You know, I do agree with the appearance part, but I also think it's everything that comes out of your mouth.
No, dressing, not just that, mental dressing. You should have the mentality as well. So inside as well, be the person that you want to be. Train every day, and eventually you will become
that. Amen to that.
Wealth is also important. It's like 95% wealth of character, but 5% actual wealth, I won't mind. That is, again, last time telling rich people I don't hate you. I love you guys, but you just motivate me, and you also tell me that I should do better. I should become something.
It's so interesting. I find your perspective
weird
so interesting.
Worldview.
Because I don't, you know, imagine, like, when I'm around anybody in life, whether poor, rich, middle class, I don't compare myself to people. I don't care about what you're doing. I really don't. I just, honestly, for me, like, I would say my biggest competition in life is not even the people around me, but my biggest competition is Satan and beating whatever he tells me. And, you know, the race to heaven. No, honestly, I mean it. Like, I don't care about what other people are doing in life, because maybe, you know, you're wealthier than me, but in the end of the day, when the world ends and, you know, when...
You want to go to the seventh heaven.
Exactly. Honestly, by the way, that's all...
Penthouse.
I mean it. That's all I think about. That's all I think about. You know, am I gonna get to heaven with the way that I behave with
heaven,
people?
Not even heaven. The top.
Inshallah. I mean, yeah, I hope
you
so.
You want the penthouse.
I hope so. No, really, I mean it. Inshallah, I hope so. But that's all that I think about. But anyways, finally, for our last story of the day, Meysa Sabrin, Syria's new central bank governor, has told Reuters in a very exclusive interview that she is pushing for greater independence for the central bank of Syria after the years of direct government control under the Bashar al-Assad regime. Now, basically, the key developments that she has actually introduced include draft amendments to enhance the central bank's autonomy and monetary policy making. Secondly, the bank is basically exploring measures to expand Islamic banking, aiming to attract more Syrians who traditionally avoided conventional banking. And overall, what these changes are doing is that they're really reflecting Syria's effort in rebuilding the country following the damage done by Bashar al-Assad's regime. Even more beautiful than all of this is the fact that these key developments, they're being done by a woman.
Yeah.
They're being suggested by a woman in Syria. That is so beautiful to see.
Also, she's one of the person who survived through the Bashar administration. She was a part of it. She was the deputy governor. And then she was made the main governor. The main idea of the story is there's two things. One, that central banks, they're usually throughout the world independent, because political interference causes problems, because a politician would love to get go with lower interest rates and all that stuff to make life easier for the people, to make them feel that they're living a good life and everything is so cheap. But eventually the debt on the country, it increases. So central banks are always kept independent, away from the political interference. But she says that under Bashar al-Assad, it wasn't happening. It was all him dictating central bank to do this and that.
So and when finally, he left, we saw what he did.
And secondly, the good thing that she said is that Syria has enough money to pay their civil servants. And they recently promised a 400% hike. Qatar came in. They were like, we'll help them with it. But she said that we have enough money to pay them. And we will build a system, and we'll build it on the basis of whatever we have. And if anyone wants to help without any strings attached, we would accept their help. But we will build it ourselves. So
and
that's
they have
a good
accepted
thing.
That help. Just on the point of Qatar, essentially Qatar is going to finance the salaries of all the government employees. But it's just Najid, like it's a woman there. This makes me so happy because, you know, I study accounting and finance. And let me tell you, there's not that many women in my class, by the way. No, really, it's mostly boys. Like, you know when like four of the girls are all on holiday, I'm just sitting there in a room full of men. So to see this, it's so inspiring. It's so beautiful. It's so special.
Women are going in unconventional fields where the males always dominated. And that's a good thing for the world.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah. And with that being said, thank you so much for watching, everyone. This is Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production under the Augustus Media Podcast Network. You can find our newsletter on Smashy TV, and please follow us on all of our channels. Have a lovely day.